It's a funny thing about games and like the assumptions we make when we sit down to play them.
Right, yeah.
Imagine you invite a group of friends over for a game night, right? You clear off the kitchen table, you unfold the checkered board, and you set up all the pieces.
Sounds fun.
Yeah, you sit down, you crack your knuckles, and you look across the table. But there is a massive, totally silent problem.
Oh, I think I know where this is going.
Like half the table looks at that checkered board and thinks they're playing chess. And the other half looks at the exact same board and is absolutely convinced they're playing checkers.
Right.
So you open the game by making a di diagonal move, you
Yeah.
know, fully expecting to jump an opponent's piece. And suddenly, someone across the table starts shouting that you've just put their king in check.
That would be total chaos.
Exactly. The pieces are the same, the board is the same, but the underlying reality of, like, what constitutes a legal physical move is entirely different. It would be unplayable.
It would be completely unplayable, realistically, because a game isn't defined by the board it's played on. You know, it's defined by the rule book that actually governs the interactions on that board.
Yeah,
If
exactly.
you don't share the exact same definitions of a boundary or a foul, an illegal maneuver, you aren't actually playing the same game, even if you're staring at the exact same
And
pieces.
yet, if you step onto an ice hockey rink tonight,
Right.
whether you're subbing in for a local adult rec league or playing a university club game or traveling across the border for an amateur tournament, you might be walking into that exact chaotic scenario without even realizing it.
Oh, absolutely. It happens all the time.
Like, you might have watched ice hockey your entire life. You might think you know the rules inside and out. But if you lace up your skates and step onto the ice, assuming the National Hockey League rulebook applies to your local Tuesday night league, you are in for a brutal awakening.
You really are.
You could find yourself ejected or severely penalized, or, I
Ooh.
mean, you could end up costing your team the game, all because you made a move that you thought was perfectly legal.
And that is really the core reality of the sport that we're going to explore today in this deep dive.
Yeah.
There is no single universal set of rules in ice hockey. The rink might look exactly the same, you know, with the same red and blue lines painted under the ice, but the invisible legal architecture sitting on top of those lines changes drastically depending on whose jurisdiction you're in.
That's wild. Hey, we're actually looking at four distinct legal universes in our source material today,
Yeah,
right?
four main words. You have the NHL, which governs professional play in North America. Then you have the IIHF, the International Ice Hockey Federation, which governs the Olympics, international tournaments, and all domestic hockey in places like the United Kingdom.
Right.
And then you have the two massive amateur governing bodies, which are USA Hockey and Hockey Canada.
So our mission today for everyone listening is to completely deconstruct those four universes.
Right, we're tearing them down to the studs.
Exactly. We're going to build a comprehensive, integrated framework in your mind so that you don't just like memorize a dry list of penalties. We want you to really understand the underlying architecture of the game.
Absolutely, because by the time we're done, you'll understand the exact triggers that shift a normal hockey play into an ejectable offense.
Yeah.
You'll understand the massive hidden strategic differences written into the fine print of these rule books. We're going to really look at the mechanics of the sport.
And the way we achieve that understanding, I think, is by constantly asking why and how, right?
Yes, exactly. A rule book is not just a list of punishments. It's essentially a living, breathing document engineered to manage two things: game flow and player safety.
Game flow and player safety, okay.
Right. Every single rule we discuss today exists because at some point in history, a player did something that disrupted the flow of the game or put another human being in physical danger.
That makes a lot of sense.
So if we understand the why, like the biomechanics of a hit, or the physics of a puck crossing a painted line, or the physiological exhaustion of a long shift, the penalties will naturally make sense.
You won't have to rote memorize them
Right.
because you'll understand the physical reality they're actually trying to govern.
Precisely.
So to really grasp the physics and the strategy, I think we have to start with the physical environment itself, the rink.
Good place to start.
When I look at a hockey rink, I just see, a sheet of white ice with some colorful lines painted on it. But those lines aren't just decorative, are they?
Not at all.
They are strict legal boundaries. Before we even get to how players interact with the geography of the ice.
Right.
So let's start with the most basic logistical act in the sport, getting onto the ice in the first place. Substituting players.
Yeah, substituting players, or changing on the fly, as it's universally called, is one of the most unique mechanics in all of sports.
Yeah, because you don't really see it anywhere else.
Right. Think about basketball or American football. If you want to put a new player into the game, you have to wait for the referee to blow the whistle. Play completely stops, the clock stops, the players jog on and off, and then the game resets.
It's very orderly.
Very. But ice hockey does not afford you that luxury. The game is far too fast, and shifts are far too exhausting. So you're allowed to substitute players while the puck is live, while the game is moving at 30 miles an hour.
Which is terrifying, honestly.
It is. But mathematically, you can only ever have five skaters and one goaltender on the ice. So if you're changing on the fly, there is inevitably going to be a brief moment where the retiring player is still on the ice and the new player has just jumped over the boards.
Right.
So for a fraction of a second, you technically have too many bodies on the rink.
Right, because if I'm jumping over the boards to replace my teammate, I'm not waiting for them to be entirely seated on the bench before my skates hit the ice. That would just take way too long. We're basically passing each other like ships in the night.
Yeah.
So how does the rule book handle that overlapping moment? Like, how close to the bench does my teammate actually have to be before I'm legally allowed to join the play?
This is where our four legal universes immediately begin to fracture. The rule books have to define a specific geographical limit to manage that overlap.
Okay.
In the NHL, and under the IIHF rules governing international play, that distance is strictly defined as 5 feet, or 1.5 meters.
Wow, 5 feet.
Yeah. The retiring player must be within a 5-foot radius of the bench door before the substitute can actually enter the physical playing surface.
5 feet is not a lot of room.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically just one long hockey stride away from the boards. Does every league operate on that tight of a margin?
Not at all. If you cross the border and play under Hockey Canada's jurisdiction, they actually double that margin.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Under Hockey Canada rules, the retiring player can be 10 feet away from the bench when the new player jumps on. Yeah, it gives the teams significantly more breathing room to execute a sloppy change without getting penalized.
Okay, so 5 feet in the pros and internationally, 10 feet in Canada. What about if I'm playing in a local league governed by USA Hockey? Do they, like, split the difference?
Well, USA Hockey takes a completely different philosophical approach. If you read their rule book, there's no specific numerical distance listed whatsoever.
Wait, really? None.
None. The rule simply states that the retiring player must be at the bench. It relies entirely on the subjective interpretation of the referee.
That sounds like it could cause some arguments.
It definitely can. But regardless of whether the distance is 5 feet, 10 feet, or subjective, the consequence of violating this geographical boundary is the exact same across all
Right.
leagues.
It results in a penalty called too many men on the ice. That's a penalty we hear called all the time on television. The whistle blows, the referee holds up a hand, and someone has to go sit in the penalty box for 2 minutes while their team plays shorthanded. But I want to break down the actual mechanics of that penalty, because if I have six skaters on the ice for a split second during a change, the referee doesn't instantly blow the whistle every single time. What actually triggers the penalty?
That is a crucial distinction to make. The sheer presence of six bodies on the ice is not, in and of itself, the infraction.
Okay.
The officials understand that changes on the fly require a brief moment of overlap. The penalty is triggered based on how those overlapping players interact with the live play.
Interacting with the play. Okay, how so?
Specifically, if either the retiring player who is heading to the bench or the new substitute who just jumped on plays the puck or makes physical contact with an opposing player while both of them are on the ice, the whistle blows.
Let me paint a scenario to make sure I'm visualizing this correctly.
Sure, go ahead.
Let's say I'm at the end of a grueling 90-second shift. My legs feel like they're filled with battery acid. I'm coasting toward the bench. I'm about 4 feet away, and my replacement jumps over the boards. But right at that moment, the opposing team tries to clear the puck down the ice. The puck comes flying through the air and accidentally hits me right in the back of the skate before I can open the bench door. We have six men on the ice, and the puck just struck one of them. Do I just cost my team a penalty?
In that specific scenario, no.
Oh, phew.
Yeah, you don't get a penalty and the play continues without a stoppage. The key verb in the rule book is playing the puck. Playing implies action and intent.
Intent. Okay.
If the puck accidentally strikes a retiring player who is making a genuine effort to get off the ice and is clearly not trying to involve themselves in the play, The referees will generally let it go. You have to actively engage, you have to try to stick handle it, or you have to throw a body check to actually trigger the too many men call.
Okay, that feels fair. It protects a player who just happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time while trying to change.
Right.
But going through the source material, I noticed a massive caveat to this under USA Hockey rules. It seems like USA Hockey has a trapdoor built into this rule that doesn't require anyone to touch the puck at all.
That trapdoor is actually one of the most fascinating strategic nuances in the amateur game. USA Hockey explicitly includes a clause regarding competitive advantage.
Competitive advantage.
Yeah. They state that if a team executes a line change that gains them a competitive territorial advantage, a too many men penalty can be assessed even if no one touches the puck and no one touches an opposing player.
Wait, how does a line change give you a competitive advantage without touching the puck? Can you walk me through what that actually looks like on the ice?
Sure. Let's visualize an odd man rush. An odd man rush is a scenario where the attacking team has more players moving forward than the defending team has back.
Okay, like a breakaway or something.
Right. Let's say the opposing team intercepts a pass and breaks out on a two-on-one. They have two forwards sprinting down the ice, and your team only has one lone defenseman skating backward to stop them.
A highly dangerous scoring opportunity.
Extremely dangerous. Now imagine this play is happening on the far side of the ice, away from your team's bench. You have a forward who is exhausted, floating near your bench. Instead of waiting for that forward to get to the door, your coach sends a fresh, fast player over the boards early.
Oh, I see.
That fresh player doesn't go for the puck. Instead, they sprint directly back to the defensive zone and catch up to the play, suddenly turning that dangerous two-on-one into a relatively safe two-on-two.
Wow. So the fresh player legally entered the play, but they did it by prematurely utilizing the bench as basically a teleportation device.
Right.
They cheated the distance.
Precisely. Under USA Hockey rules, winning that territorial advantage and neutralizing an opponent's scoring threat by jumping on early is the infraction itself.
That's amazing.
Yeah. The referee will blow the whistle and penalize you for too many men, purely based on the geographic advantage you stole, regardless of puck contact.
That dramatically shifts how a coach has to think about line changes. The underlying logic here seems to be that a line change is not just administrative bookkeeping. You know, it's a vulnerable defensive act.
It absolutely is.
If your team doesn't have control of the puck, changing your players is inherently dangerous.
It is the ultimate vulnerability. If you're halfway to the bench and your team turns the puck over, your human instinct might be to turn around and try to help on defense. But the rulebook strictly forbids that.
Right, you're committed.
Yes. If you're changing and the play turns against you, you have to commit. Finish the trip, get off the ice, and let your substitute handle it. If you turn around and engage while your substitute is already on the ice, you will be sitting in the penalty box.
Makes sense. So we've established how players legally enter the playing surface using the bench doors. Let's move on to the ice itself and look at the most famous geographic boundary in the sport.
The blue line.
Okay, the blue line. Yeah, there are two blue lines on the ice, and they divide the rink into three zones. The defensive zone, the neutral zone in the middle, and the offensive zone. And the primary function of that offensive blue line is to govern the rule of offside.
Right.
How would you define the core fundamental concept of offside to someone who has never watched a game?
At its most basic level, the rule of offside dictates that the attacking players cannot precede the puck into the offensive zone. The puck must always be the first thing to cross the painted blue line.
The puck goes first, got it.
Exactly. If an attacking player completely crosses the blue line before the puck does, they're offside, and the linesperson will stop the play. The purpose of this rule, historically, was to prevent cherry picking, where a team would just leave a player standing down by the opponent's goalie all game long, waiting for a long pass.
Which would be boring to watch.
Very. The blue line forces teams to advance up the ice as a cohesive unit.
That sounds simple enough in theory. The puck has to go first. But when you watch a game, players are attacking that blue line at incredibly high speeds. They're stick handling. They're contorting their bodies to stay onside. They're reaching backward.
Oh, yeah. It's highly athletic.
Right. So I want to clear up a massive physical misconception right out of the gate. When the linesperson is judging whether a player is offside, what part of the player's body are they actually looking at? because players hold these long composite sticks, and often their stick is 3 feet deep into the offensive zone while they are waiting for a pass.
The stick is entirely irrelevant for the purposes of determining offside.
Totally irrelevant.
Totally. The torso is irrelevant. The hands are irrelevant. The rule of offside is determined entirely, 100%, by the player's skates.
Ah, the skates.
Specifically, the metal blade of the skate. As long as one of the attacking player's skate blades remains in contact with the blue line or the neutral zone, they are considered onside, regardless of where the rest of their body or their stick is reaching.
Okay, so it's all about the trailing skate, the skate that is lagging behind, trying to anchor the player to the legal side of the boundary.
Right, the anchor.
But here is where reading the source material completely broke my brain, because the definition of what constitutes a legal trailing skate changes wildly depending on the rule book.
It really does.
Can you explain the concept of the three-dimensional plane versus the painted ice?
This is perhaps the most significant geometric divergence in all of hockey, and it fundamentally alters how players move. Let's look at the NHL and the IIHF rule books first.
Okay, pros and international.
In those professional and international leagues, the blue line is not just a flat piece of paint under the ice. It is treated as a three-dimensional vertical plane. Imagine a pane of glass extending straight up into the air from the leading edge of the blue line.
Like a laser grid pointing up to the ceiling.
Exactly, like a laser grid. Under NHL and IIHF rules, as long as your trailing skate has not broken that invisible vertical plane, you are onside. This means your trailing skate does not actually have to be touching the ice surface.
Right, really?
Yeah, it can be completely airborne, hovering a foot above the ice in the neutral zone, and as long as it hasn't crossed that vertical plane, the play is legal.
That makes sense for the pros, I guess.
Yeah.
But if I take that exact same physical maneuver, hovering my back leg in the air as I cross the line, and I try to do it in an amateur game governed by USA Hockey or Hockey Canada, what happens?
The lines person will immediately blow their whistle and call you offside.
Instantly.
Instantly. Because in USA Hockey and Hockey Canada, that three-dimensional vertical plane does not exist. The boundary is strictly two-dimensional. In order to remain onside in those amateur leagues, your trailing skate must be in physical, tangible contact with the ice surface itself, either touching the blue paint or the white ice of the neutral zone.
Wow.
If your skate lifts even 1 millimeter off the ice before the puck crosses the line, you are instantly offside.
I really want to emphasize the biomechanical reality of what you just described, because it completely changes the technique of a zone entry.
It does.
Imagine I'm a forward, and I'm sprinting toward the offensive blue line at full speed. I'm waiting for my defenseman to pass me the puck. I realize I'm going too fast, and I'm going to cross the line before the puck gets there. Under NHL rules, I can just lift my front leg, coast over the line, and leave my back leg hovering in the air behind me like a gymnast, using my momentum to slide forward while legally anchoring myself in the air.
Which is a very fluid, natural, athletic movement when you're traveling at high speeds.
Right. But if I try that in a USA Hockey League, it's a dead play. If the rule says my skate must touch the ice, that means I physically have to press my steel blade into the frozen surface while traveling 20 miles an hour. I have to drag my foot.
Yes, you do.
That creates immense friction. It throws off your balance, it twists your hips, and it completely alters your momentum. You are fundamentally changing the biomechanics of a high-speed athletic maneuver based purely on which governing body printed the rule book.
It's a perfect example of how legal jurisdiction dictates physical motion. The NHL adopted the three-dimensional plane specifically to increase offensive flow and reduce the number of ticky-tack offside whistles.
Right. More goals, more excitement.
Exactly. But the amateur bodies kept the physical touch rule, likely because it is significantly easier for a single amateur lines person to judge a skate touching the ice than it is to judge an invisible plane hovering in midair.
That makes practical sense.
Yeah.
That leads me to the next phase of offside. We know how to enter the zone legally. But what happens when a team messes up?
Right, the mistakes.
Yeah, the attacking team crosses the blue line before the puck. They are clearly offside. But the linesperson doesn't immediately blow the whistle. Instead, they raise their arms straight up in the air and yell. This is called a delayed offside. Why doesn't the play just stop instantly?
The delayed offside exists to reward the defending team for making a good play. Let's say the attacking team dumps the puck into the offensive zone, but one of their players is already in there. They're offside. However, the defending team immediately gains possession of the puck, and they're in a clear, unpressured position to skate it back out of the zone. If the linesperson blew the whistle instantly, it would actually penalize the defending team by stopping their momentum and forcing a face-off.
Ah, I see.
So the linesperson raises their arm to signal a delayed offside, allowing the defending team a chance to clear the puck natively.
Okay, so the arm is up, my attacking team is offside, we want to make the play legal again so we can try to score. I know the process for this is called tagging up. What does tagging up physically require the offending team to do?
To nullify a delayed offside, every single attacking player must clear the offensive zone. They must retreat back into the neutral zone and make skate contact with the blue line.
Everyone has to touch the blue line.
Yes. And crucially, they must all clear the zone simultaneously. The offensive zone must be completely devoid of attacking players for at least a fraction of a second.
So if I sprint back and touch the blue line, but my teammate is still slowly coasting out of the deep corner, my tag doesn't count yet.
Correct. The zone is not legally cleared until that teammate in the corner also makes contact with the blue line. Until that happens, the delayed offside remains in effect.
This presents a really interesting tactical scenario. I'm an attacker. The linesperson's arm is up. I know I have to leave the zone. But a defending player has the puck right in front of me. Why should I retreat? Can I just stand there, hover menacingly, and try to pressure them into panicking and turning the puck over, as long as I don't touch the puck myself?
If you attempt that under NHL or IIHF rules, you will kill the play immediately.
Really?
Yes. This is a fatal trap that destroys offensive possessions in every game because players do not understand the specific triggers that cancel a delayed offside. You do not have to touch the puck to force a whistle.
Wow.
Okay, under the professional and international rules, if you so much as chase the defending puck carrier deeper into their own zone, the whistle blows. Furthermore, if the linesperson judges that you are about to make physical contact with the puck carrier, the play is blown dead. Your mere aggressive proximity is enough to stop the game.
So the referee is essentially punishing the defense for a mistake the offense made by stopping the play before the defense can break out.
Exactly. If the attacker forces the issue, the linesperson has no choice but to blow it dead to protect the defending team's right to an unpressured clear. However, this is another area where the rule books diverge significantly.
Let me guess. The North American amateur leagues handle this differently.
Very differently. USA Hockey does not use the about to make contact language. They require the attacking player to apply actual pressure on the puck carrier, which is a much more subjective threshold for a referee to judge.
Okay.
And Hockey Canada is incredibly lenient in this regard. Yeah. Their rulebook has no explicit stoppage for being about to make contact during a delayed offside. If you are a defending defenseman in a Canadian amateur league and the delayed offside arm goes up, do not expect the linesperson's whistle to save you from an incoming forechecker. You have to move the puck yourself.
Man. The ultimate takeaway here for a player seems simple. If the arm goes up, suppress your instinct to attack. Retreat. Don't drift. Don't try to be clever. And don't chase the puck carrier. Hit the brakes, sprint back to the blue line, tag up, and reset the zone so your team can legally re-engage.
Exactly. That's the perfect mental model for it.
Yeah, but let's look at the worst-case scenario. We fail to tag up, someone touches the puck, or someone applies too much pressure, and the linesperson blows the whistle. We are guilty of offside. Where does the ensuing face-off take place? Because my understanding from the source material is that this is not just a neutral reset. It can be a severe territorial punishment.
It can be. Face-off location is entirely dependent on how the puck crossed the blue line to create the offside in the first place. The rule book differentiates between carrying the puck and passing the puck.
Okay, carrying versus passing.
Right. If an attacking player carries the puck over the blue line on their stick, but one of their teammates preceded them and caused an offside, the resulting faceoff takes place at the nearest faceoff dot in the neutral zone, just a few feet outside the blue line.
You lose your offensive momentum, but you are still parked right outside the enemy gates. You haven't lost much ground.
Exactly. But let's look at the alternative. Suppose your team is under heavy pressure in your own defensive zone. A defenseman panics, blindly fires a long pass up the ice, and the puck crosses the offensive blue line. However, a forward was already standing in the offensive zone. Offside.
Because it was a pass.
Right. In this scenario, because the offside was caused by a pass, the faceoff does not stay near the blue line. It is dragged all the way back down the ice to the faceoff dot closest to where that pass originated.
Which would be deep in our own defensive end. So because my defenseman threw a hopeful pass that resulted in an offside, the referee moves the puck 89 feet backward and forces us to take a defensive zone faceoff. There's a massive territorial penalty.
It is a devastating punishment. Taking a defensive zone faceoff means your opponents are just one draw away from a high danger scoring chance. The strategic implication for a player is clear. If you are under pressure and you need to gain the offensive zone, carrying the puck over the blue line is vastly safer than firing a blind pass. If you carry it and mess up, you stay in neutral territory. If you pass it and mess up, you are trapped in your own end.
That perfectly transitions us to our next major geographical concept. We have explored the blue line and the mechanics of entering the offensive zone. Now we have to look at the center red line, which governs the exact opposite scenario. Desperately trying to clear the puck out of your own zone. We are talking about icing. How do we define the fundamental act of icing the puck?
Icing is essentially the tax on a bad defensive clear. It occurs when a player shoots the puck from their own half of the ice all the way down the rink and it crosses the opponent's goal line without anyone touching it.
Okay, all the way down the ice.
Crucially, icing can only be called if the team shooting the puck is at equal or superior numerical strength to their opponent. If you are playing 5-on-5 and you just blindly hammer the puck down the entire length of the ice to relieve pressure, that is icing.
To avoid an icing call, the defending team must execute what is called gaining the line. They have to advance the puck far enough up the ice before shooting it. And the line they have to gain is the thick red line slicing directly across the center of the rink.
Right, center red line.
But the mechanics of how a player legally gains that red line is widely misunderstood, isn't it? People seem to think it is based on the player's body position.
Yes. The common misconception is that if a player simply steps on the red line with their skate and dumps the puck, they are safe from icing. That is completely incorrect.
Wait, really?
Yes. Under NHL and IIHF rules, the physical location of the player's body is completely irrelevant. To legally gain the line and avoid icing, the puck on the player's stick must make physical contact with the center red line before it is shot. The reach of the stick is what matters.
So, picture a scenario. A defender is at the end of a long shift. They are skating up the ice. A forechecker is breathing down their neck. The defender is 2 feet short of the red line. They reach their stick out as far as they can, touching the puck to the red paint, and then sweep it down the ice. Their skates never left their own half, but the puck touched the line. That is a legal play.
That is a perfectly legal clear in the NHL and IIHF. But we must note a very specific mechanic regarding the skate. What if the player doesn't use their stick? What if they are skating, the puck is in their feet, they kick the puck over the red line with their skate blade and then shoot it?
Oh, that's a good question.
In the professional and international rules, kicking the puck over the line does not count for gaining the line. The puck must be propelled by the stick.
Let me guess, the amateur rule books handle this with a different geometric philosophy.
Naturally, USA Hockey and Hockey Canada do not explicitly distinguish between the stick and the skate for this specific action. Instead, they look at the point of last contact.
Point of last contact, okay.
They judge where the puck was when it last made physical contact with the player or their equipment. If the last touch occurred before the red line, it's icing. If it occurred on or past the red line, it's legal. But practically speaking, for a player on the ice, the safest mental framework is universal. Ensure the physical puck itself reaches the red paint before you send it away.
Okay, so we understand how to avoid it. But let's say I fail. I panic, I don't gain the red line, and I shoot the puck all the way down the ice. It crosses the opponent's goal line. The Lions person signals icing. What happens next? Because historically, the sequence of events following an icing has changed dramatically, right?
Okay.
And it used to be incredibly dangerous.
We have to look at the evolution of the rule, yeah. Historically, the sport utilized something called touch icing. In that era, simply shooting the puck across the goal line didn't instantly stop the play. It initiated a foot race.
A race to the puck.
Exactly. In order for the icing to actually be called, a defending player had to skate all the way down the ice and physically touch the puck first. If an attacking player touched it first, the icing was waved off and play continued deep in the zone.
That sounds like a recipe for absolute disaster. You are incentivizing two massive athletes to skate at maximum speed, side by side, directly toward the solid wooden boards at the end of the rink, with their primary focus on touching a little piece of rubber rather than protecting themselves.
It was incredibly dangerous. Touch icing resulted in catastrophic injuries, shattered femurs, concussions, and severe spinal trauma, because players would collide at top speed just feet from the end boards. Because of those horrific outcomes, pure touch icing has been largely eradicated from the modern game. Today, we generally operate under two different systems designed to mitigate that danger.
What is the first system?
The first is no-touch, or automatic icing, which is heavily utilized by USA Hockey across most of its amateur levels. Under this system, the foot race is completely eliminated. The instant the puck crosses the opponent's goal line, the linesperson blows the whistle. The play is dead immediately. It maximizes safety by entirely removing the high-speed pursuit into the boards.
But the NHL and the IIHF didn't want to completely kill the excitement of the foot race, did they? They use a system called hybrid icing. And reading the mechanics of how hybrid icing is judged by the officials is fascinating because it involves a very specific geographical deadline. How does hybrid icing actually work on the ice?
Hybrid icing attempts to balance the excitement of the race with the necessity of safety. When a puck is iced, it still initiates a foot race down the ice between an attacker and a defender. However, the race does not end at the puck, and it does not end at the goal line.
Where does it end?
The linesperson, who is skating backward to keep up with the play, must make a definitive judgment on who is going to win that race by the time the first skater reaches the end zone faceoff dot.
So the faceoff dot, which is painted on the ice roughly 20 feet in front of the goal line, acts as an invisible finish line for the referee's decision.
Exactly. The dot is a deadline for the decision, not the physical finish line of the race itself. As the players sprint past that face-off dot, the linesperson evaluates their speed and positioning. If the defending player is clearly ahead and is going to reach the puck first, the linesperson blows the whistle right then and there, calling the icing before the players ever reach the dangerous area near the boards.
And if the attacker is ahead?
If the attacking player is clearly going to win the race, the linesperson waves their arms, nullifying the icing, and the play continues live.
And what if it is a dead heat? What if they cross that face-off dot shoulder to shoulder and the linesperson simply cannot tell who's going to get to the puck first?
In the event of a tie at the face-off dot, the rulebook mandates that safety must prevail. The linesperson is instructed to blow the whistle and enforce the icing call.
So the whistle blows. My team is guilty of icing the puck. Why is this such a terrifying prospect for a coach? Because to a casual observer, it just looks like a minor stoppage in play. The referee blows the whistle, picks up the puck, and drops it again. But you described it earlier as a brutal strategic punishment. What actually happens to the offending team when they ice the puck in the NHL or the IIHF?
The punishment in the professional and international ranks is threefold, and it is designed to exploit physical exhaustion. First, the resulting faceoff is moved all the way down the ice into your defensive zone. You are now defending a face-off 20 feet from your own goaltender.
Go bad territory.
Second, and this is the most critical punishment, the team that iced the puck is strictly forbidden from substituting their players. The five skaters who were on the ice when the puck was shot are legally required to stay on the ice for the ensuing face-off.
We really need to contextualize how physically punishing that is. A typical hockey shift is maybe 45 seconds of maximum anaerobic exertion. If a team is pinned in their own zone for a minute, their legs are burning, they are gasping for air, their heart rate is spiking, they finally get the puck, panic, and ice it down the rink. And the referee points at them and says, "No, you can't go to the bench. You have to stay out here."
You are trapped. Your legs are filled with lactic acid. And to make matters worse, the opposing coach, who is not restricted by the substitution ban, gets to send their freshest, most dangerous offensive players over the boards to face your exhausted, trapped defenders.
And just to close the loop on the desperation, a coach might think, okay, my guys are trapped and exhausted. I'll just use my one timeout for the game to give them 30 seconds to breathe.
Yeah, the NHL and IIHF rulebooks anticipated that loophole. The third punishment of an icing call is that the offending team is explicitly barred from calling a timeout. You cannot buy rest. You must line up and defend.
That is a masterclass in using the rulebook to force strategic vulnerability. But as we keep discovering, the legal universe changes when we look at American amateur hockey. Does USA Hockey impose this exact same nightmare scenario on a team that ices the puck?
This is a massive point of divergence. USA Hockey offers a tremendous structural relief to its players.
No.
If you ice the puck under USA Hockey rules, you suffer the territorial punishment, the faceoff comes back to your defensive zone. However, you do not suffer the substitution ban, and you do not suffer the timeout ban. You are completely free to open the bench doors, pull your exhausted players off the ice, and send out a fresh defensive unit.
That fundamentally alters the strategic risk-reward calculation of the game. If I am a defenseman in the NHL, I might try a risky pass to avoid icing, because I know if I ice it, I'm going to be stuck on the ice for another minute and I might collapse. But if I am a defenseman playing USA Hockey, The penalty for icing is just a defensive zone face-off with fresh legs. I will happily fire that puck down the ice every single time I am in trouble. The rulebook is actively dictating whether a player attempts a high-skill breakout pass or just blindly hammers the puck away.
It dictates the stylistic flow of the entire game. But before we leave the concept of icing, we must establish one universal exception that every player must understand. We noted earlier that icing only applies if teams are at equal numerical strength. What happens if your team is killing a penalty?
This is the penalty kill exception. If one of my teammates committed a foul and is sitting in the penalty box, my team is playing shorthanded. We only have 4 skaters against their 5.
Exactly. When your team is officially shorthanded on the scoreboard, the rule of icing is suspended for your team. You are granted a free pass to shoot the puck down the entire length of the ice as many times as you want without any whistle or stoppage.
That's huge for the defense.
It is the single biggest structural advantage granted to a penalty-killing unit, allowing them to relieve pressure and bleed the clock. Now, there are a few hyper-specific exceptions. For instance, some very young USA hockey youth levels do not allow this, and the NHL has a niche rule if a team pulls their goalie for an extra attacker while already shorthanded. But as a foundational principle, if you are down a man, fire the puck down the ice.
Let's pause and synthesize what we have covered in these first two segments.
Mm-hmm.
We started with the physical boundaries of the rink. We looked at the bench doors and the 5-foot radius for substitutions. We dissected the blue line, understanding that the NHL uses a hovering vertical plane while amateur leagues demand physical skate contact.
Right.
We explored the delayed offside and the severe 89-foot territorial punishment for passing the puck offside. And finally, we just broke down the red line, the hybrid icing foot race to the faceoff dot, and the exhausting substitution bans that follow a bad clear.
If we look at the underlying pattern of those rules, what does it reveal about the architecture of the sport?
It reveals that geography is destiny. The lines on the ice dictate your physical reality. Where the puck is, where your skate blade is touching, and which specific painted line you just crossed determines whether you get to go to the bench for a drink of water, or whether you are trapped on the ice, lungs burning, defending against a fresh offensive line.
And when players get trapped on the ice tired, a physiological chain reaction occurs. Exhausted players stop moving their feet. When they stop moving their feet, they lose optimal defensive body position. When they lose position, they panic. They reach, they grab, they lunge, and they make desperate, dangerous physical decisions.
Which leads us perfectly into the consequences of those desperate decisions. Penalties. We are going to build a framework for how the rulebook punishes fouls, starting from a basic 2-minute timeout and escalating all the way to permanent ejections. How does the penalty ladder actually work?
The penalty ladder is a hierarchy of severity. The foundation of that ladder is the minor penalty. This is assessed for common infractions like tripping, hooking, or minor interference. The offending player is sent to the penalty box for 2 minutes. Crucially, their team must play shorthanded for that duration, meaning they play 5-on-4. However, a minor penalty has a release valve. If the opposing team scores a goal on the ensuing power play, the penalty instantly ends and the player is freed from the box.
So a minor penalty costs you 2 minutes, or one goal, whichever comes first.
Right.
And then you have something called a bench minor, which I assume operates under the same time constraints.
Yes. A bench minor is identical in duration and consequence. 2 minutes shorthanded ends on a goal. The distinction is that it is called against the team as a whole, rather than a specific individual. We discussed this earlier with the too many men penalty. Because it is a team infraction, the coach can select any player currently on the ice to go serve the time. Moving up the ladder, we reach the double minor.
A double minor is 4 minutes in the box. I usually see this called when a player commits a high-sticking foul that accidentally draws blood.
Correct. It is effectively 2 consecutive minor penalties stacked on top of each other. During the first 2 minutes, it only cancels the first half of the penalty. The clock resets to 2 minutes, and the team remains shorthanded.
Okay, so that covers the minor infractions. But what happens when a player commits a severe foul, an intentional, dangerous hit? We step up to the major penalty. What makes a major so devastating?
A major penalty is 5 minutes in the box. Like a minor, the team must play shorthanded. But a major removes the release valve.
No release valve.
None. If you are assessed a major penalty, you sit in that box for the full 5 minutes, absolutely, regardless of how many goals the opposing team scores. They could score 3, 4, or 5 goals on that 5-minute power play, and your penalty does not end. It is a catastrophic mathematical disadvantage for a team, and it is reserved for the most dangerous physical fouls in the sport.
Wow, okay. If a 5-minute major is catastrophic, then what on earth is a misconduct penalty? Because when I look at the scoreboard, a misconduct puts 10 minutes up on the clock. Doesn't losing a player for 10 minutes absolutely destroy a team's chances of winning?
This is perhaps the most widely misunderstood penalty structure in all of recreational hockey. Let me clarify this definitively. A misconduct penalty, which is 10 minutes, or a game misconduct, which is an ejection for the remainder of the match, does not make your team play shorthanded.
Wait, really? You lose a player for 10 minutes, or you get thrown out entirely, and your team doesn't lose a man on the ice?
Correct. When a misconduct is called, the offending player goes to the box or the locker room, but the coach is allowed to send a substitute onto the ice immediately. The team remains at full 5-on-5 strength.
Oh, wow.
The underlying logic here is that a misconduct is designed to punish the individual player, usually for severe unsportsmanlike conduct, verbal abuse of an official, or escalating an altercation by removing them from the game. It is a behavioral punishment. It is not designed to punish the scoreboard by forcing the team to defend shorthanded.
That is a vital distinction to understand. You lose the talent of the player, but you do not lose the geometric advantage on the ice. Now, what happens when these penalties start accumulating? If a player just keeps committing dangerous fouls, at what point does the referee simply kick them out of the game?
This is where we see a fascinating divergence in tolerance between the professional and international levels. In the NHL, a player is allowed a surprising amount of leeway. It takes a third major penalty in a single game to trigger an automatic game misconduct ejection.
3 major penalties. That means a player could theoretically commit 2 vicious 5-minute fouls, serve their time, and still be allowed back on the ice to finish the game. That seems incredibly lenient.
It reflects the NHL's historical tolerance for physical policing, specifically fighting, which is assessed as a major penalty but rarely results in an ejection. However, if we look across the ocean to the IIHF, which governs Olympic play and all British domestic hockey, the tolerance for major fouls is virtually non-existent.
Oh, really?
Under IIHF rules, your second major penalty of any kind triggers an automatic game misconduct. Furthermore, the IIHF rulebook lists 17 specific physical infractions where your very first major penalty comes with a mandatory automatic game misconduct attached. 1 major foul, and your night is over.
That strictness brings us directly into the most critical and heavily debated aspect of modern hockey, player safety and body fouls. The sport is played at incredibly high speeds by massive athletes wearing body armor, colliding in a confined space surrounded by rigid walls. The rules governing how you can hit someone are paramount.
And when reviewing the source material, I noticed a concept that I am going to call the head contact paradox. Can you explain the vast chasm and how the different rule books handle hits to the head? The treatment of head contact highlights the stark philosophical divide between the NHL and the rest of the hockey world. The NHL, frankly, is the outlier, and they maintain the most lenient standards regarding head contact. In the NHL, an illegal check to the head is generally assessed as a simple 2-minute minor penalty.
2 minutes for a headshot?
Yeah. The referee has the discretion to escalate it to a major or a match penalty, but they typically only do so if they determine the hit was a deliberate, targeted attempt to injure the opponent.
So in the NHL, you can hit a player in the head, cause a concussion, and as long as the referee thinks it was just a sloppy hockey play rather than malicious intent, you only sit in the box for 2 minutes.
Exactly. But if you transition to the IIHF, USA Hockey, or Hockey Canada, that leniency completely vanishes. In amateur and international hockey, any contact with the head, accidental, careless, or intentional, is treated with extreme severity. A hit to the head in those leagues is routinely assessed as a major penalty plus an automatic game misconduct. The intent does not matter. If your shoulder contacts their chin, you are ejected.
That strict liability makes sense for amateur leagues trying to protect brains. But that brings us to the most counterintuitive, mind-bending rule we found in all the source material. It is a rule regarding head contact that feels completely backwards when you first read it. Let's talk about the ducking rule under Hockey Canada and the IIHF.
The ducking rule is a perfect illustration of a rule book prioritizing long-term biomechanical safety over short-term human instinct.
Okay.
Let's set the scenario. You have an attacker carrying the puck along the boards. A defender approaches to deliver a legal shoulder-to-shoulder body check. At the very last millisecond, the attacker realizes they're about to get hit. Their natural human instinct kicks in. They duck. They crouch down low and tuck their head to avoid the impact. Because they ducked, the defender's shoulder, which was aimed at the chest, now violently strikes the attacker directly in the head.
Okay, so the attacker is down on the ice holding their head, and the defender just delivered a headshot. Under the strict rules we just discussed, that defender is about to be ejected, right?
This is where the paradox occurs. Under Hockey Canada and IIHF rules, in that specific scenario, the defender who delivered the headshot receives absolutely no penalty.
Wait. The person who inflicted the head trauma is completely exonerated.
Fully exonerated. The rulebook explicitly states that if the head contact was caused solely by the victim altering their posture at the last moment by ducking or crouching, the checker is not at fault. But it goes further than exoneration.
How could it go further?
The player who ducked, the victim who just took a shoulder to the skull, can actually be assessed a minor, a major, or even a match penalty for the infraction of clipping or crouching.
That sounds utterly insane. You get hit in the head, the guy who hit you goes free, and you get sent to the penalty box. Why on earth would a rule book punish a player for trying to duck out of the way of a speeding human missile?
To understand the why, we have to look at human anatomy, specifically the cervical spine. When you are standing normally, your spine has a natural curve that helps absorb shock. But when you tuck your chin to your chest and duck down, you physically straighten your cervical spine, the vertebrae in your neck.
Oh, I see where this is going.
If you take a violent impact into the boards or from an opposing player while your cervical spine is straightened, the kinetic energy has nowhere to dissipate. The force travels directly down the stacked vertebrae.
Axial loading.
Exactly. It is the primary biomechanical mechanism for catastrophic, life-altering spinal injuries, fractured vertebrae, and permanent paralysis.
Oh, wow. So the rulebook is basically acting as a structural engineer for the human body.
Yes. The rulebook is explicitly stating, it is physically safer for you to absorb a heavy body check squarely on your shoulder, hip, or chest than it is for you to duck and risk snapping your neck. The human instinct to curl into a ball is dangerous on a hockey rink.
That is fascinating.
The rule penalizes the victim to aggressively enforce proper physical technique. It forces players to keep their heads up, keep their knees bent, and take hits properly along the wall with their skates parallel to the boards. It overrides instinct with mandated safety.
That is a phenomenal piece of insight. It changes how you watch the game entirely. Let's look at another physical foul that relies on body position. Checking from behind. This is universally despised across all leagues.
Checking from behind is the ultimate cowardly act in hockey. It involves hitting a defenseless player squarely in the numbers on their back, usually driving them violently face first into the boards or the glass. Because the player cannot see the hit coming, they cannot brace for impact.
How do the rule books handle the punishment for this? Is there a 2-minute minor option if the hit wasn't that hard?
In the NHL and the IIHF, the tolerance is zero. There is no minor penalty option available in the rulebook for checking from behind into the boards. If a referee calls it, they are mandated to assess an automatic major penalty and a game misconduct. You hit a player in the numbers, you are done for the night, and your team kills a 5-minute penalty.
Let's address one more physical foul, because this one is plagued by a pervasive myth among fans. Charging. Whenever a player takes a long run at an opponent and delivers a huge hit, you will inevitably hear fans in the stands screaming, "He took 3 strides, that's charging." What is the actual definition of charging, and does this mythical step counter exist?
The stride count is a complete myth. Some historical rulebooks or coaching manuals might mention 2 or 3 strides as a general guideline, but it is not the legal definition. Charging is about the violence of the acceleration and the distance traveled. USA Hockey's rulebook is the most explicit in dismantling this myth. They clearly state that a player can be called for charging with 0 strides.
How can you charge someone without taking a single stride?
Imagine a player who starts at the center red line. They take a few hard crossovers to build up maximum speed, and then they glide. They glide for 40 feet across the ice without taking a single stride, zero in on a stationary defender, and absolutely launch their body through the opponent to punish them.
Wow, okay.
Even though they were gliding at the moment of impact, they utilized an excessive, unnatural distance to weaponize their momentum. The referee judges the intent, the distance traveled, and the violence of the impact. The mechanical act of stepping your feet is irrelevant.
So, we have covered physical fouls. Hits to the head, hits from behind, charging. Those are fouls based on how a player uses their physical mass.
Mm-hmm.
But players also carry a weapon in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
Stick fouls often feel different than body fouls. They rarely feel like calculated tactical moves. They usually happen when a player is out of position, desperate, and reaches out to equalize the situation. Let's transition to how the rulebook manages the use of this stick.
Stick fouls escalate incredibly rapidly in severity because, as you mentioned, the stick is a solid composite weapon. The two most dangerous stick infractions are spearing and butt-ending.
Let's define those physically. Spearing is when you use the actual blade of the stick, right?
Correct. Spearing is a stabbing motion with the blade of the stick, usually directed at an opponent's abdomen or groin. Butt-ending is similar, but it involves jabbing an opponent with the top of the stick shaft, the knob end, usually into the ribs or the face during a close quarters scrum. Both of these actions are viewed by every governing body as malicious, weaponized assaults.
What is the penalty for using your stick like a bayonet?
Across all rule books, NHL, IIHF, USA, and Canada, these fouls bypass minor penalties entirely. Attempting to spear or butt in someone, even if you miss, is an automatic double minor. Actually making contact guarantees a major and a game misconduct, or a match penalty, which carries further league suspensions.
Okay, those are clearly intentional acts of violence. But what about accidental stick fouls? High sticking is probably the most common one. I see referees blow the whistle for high sticks all the time, but nobody goes to the penalty box. Why is that?
We have to draw a strict legal distinction between high sticking the puck and high sticking a player. They are governed entirely differently. If you high stick the puck, meaning you raise the blade of your stick above the normal height of your shoulders to bat a puck out of midair, it is not a time-serving penalty.
Just a stoppage in play.
Right. It is simply a violation of game flow. The referee will blow the whistle, stop the play, and move the face off to penalize your team territorially. The same applies if you bat a puck into the net with a stick raised above the crossbar. The goal is disallowed, but you don't go to the box.
But if that stick hits a human being instead of a piece of rubber,
then it immediately becomes a time-serving penalty for reckless endangerment. Hitting an opponent in the head or face with your stick is a standard 2-minute minor, escalating to a 4-minute double minor if it draws blood.
I found a fascinating clause regarding high sticks in the Hockey Canada Youth Rules. It essentially punishes a player for attempting to make a highlight reel play and failing.
Yes, this is a rule strictly enforcing stick control among younger players. Imagine a puck pops up into the air. A player winds up like a baseball batter, takes a massive wild swing at the airborne puck, and completely misses it. But the follow-through of that wild swing accidentally smashes an opposing player in the face mask.
Normally, that would just be a careless 2-minute minor for high-sticking.
But under Hockey Canada youth rules, because that wild missed swing resulted in contact with the head, it automatically escalates to a head contact major. The player's attempt to make a flashy play resulted in a loss of stick control, and that loss of control gets them ejected from the game.
That is a harsh lesson in spatial awareness. Now, let's move away from physical fouls entirely and look at a category I find uniquely stressful. Administrative traps. These are penalties where you don't hit anyone, you don't slash anyone, you just violate a logistical rule of the game. The most famous one is delay of game, specifically the puck over glass rule.
The puck over glass rule is one of the most rigidly enforced strict liability rules in the NHL and IIHF. The premise is simple. If a defending player is inside their own defensive zone and they shoot the puck directly out of the playing surface and over the glass, it is an automatic 2-minute minor penalty for delay of game.
When you say strict liability, you mean intent is totally irrelevant.
Completely irrelevant. The player could be panicking under pressure, trying to flip it high to clear the zone and accidentally put too much elevation on it. Or they could just mishandle the puck on their blade. If it goes cleanly over the glass without deflecting off the boards, the glass, or another player, they are going to the penalty box. No arguments, no referee discretion.
So if I try to clear it and it nicks the helmet of an opposing forechecker on the way up and over the glass,
then there is no penalty. The deflection absolves you. It must be a clean, direct shot out of bounds.
Okay, that rule is fairly well known by fans. But the source material revealed a hidden trapdoor in the NHL and IIHF rule books regarding this penalty that caught me entirely off guard. That strict liability rule only applies to a puck shot from the defensive zone. What is the second half of the rule?
The second half of the rule dictates that deliberately shooting the puck out of bounds from anywhere on the ice surface is a 2-minute minor. That includes the neutral zone and the offensive zone. But the true trap lies in the timing. This rule applies even after the whistle has blown.
Let me make sure I understand this. The linesperson blows the whistle for an offside. The play is officially dead. The player stops skating. I have the puck on my stick. Out of mild frustration, or just casual absent-mindedness, I flip the puck up into the spectator, netting above the glass. You are telling me that is a 2-minute penalty.
In the NHL and IIHF, yes. Players mistakenly believe that because the whistle blew, the legal reality of the game is paused and they can casually flick the puck away. The rule book disagrees. Deliberately shooting the puck out of play during a stoppage is a delay of game minor.
That feels incredibly harsh for a dead puck scenario. But I assume USA Hockey, with its focus on amateur play, is a bit more forgiving about a frustrated kid flipping a puck into the netting.
Actually, USA Hockey is downright terrifying on this specific issue. They view shooting the puck out of play after the whistle not just as a delay of game, but as an act of severe dissent and unsportsmanlike conduct. If a player intentionally shoots the puck out of bounds after the whistle under USA Hockey rules, the referee can instantly bypass a 2-minute minor and assess a 10-minute misconduct.
10 minutes for flicking a puck.
It gets worse. If the referee judges that the player shot the puck out of play in protest of an official's call, say, they were angry about a tripping penalty, it escalates to a game misconduct. They are ejected. And if the player carelessly shoots the puck anywhere near an official in their frustration, it is assessed as a match penalty, which carries mandatory league suspensions. A player's season could be put in jeopardy because they angrily swatted a dead puck.
The ultimate lesson there. When the whistle blows, drop your stick, leave the puck exactly where it is, and skate away. Do not touch it. Before we move on to our final topic, I want to test my own understanding of the geographic concepts we discussed earlier, combined with these administrative rules. I want to pose a scenario regarding a goaltender.
Oh, lay it on me.
Let's say a goalie comes way out of their net to play a loose puck near the center red line. The goalie stops at the red line. Their skates physically slide over the red paint into the offensive half of the ice. However, the goalie reaches back, and the puck they are stick handling is still located on their defensive side of the red line. Is that a legal play?
That is an excellent synthesis question. Think back to our discussion on offside and icing. How do the different rule books judge boundaries?
Okay, let's break it down. We learned that the NHL and the IIHF generally judge boundaries based on the location of the puck. They don't care where the player's body is for icing, they care what the puck is. So, under NHL and IIHF rules, because the puck is still on the defensive side of the line, the goalie's play should be totally legal, even if their skates are across the line.
Spot on. The NHL and IIHF rulebooks explicitly state that the puck's position dictates the legality of the goaltender's action at the center line.
But we also learned that USA Hockey and Hockey Canada are obsessed with the physical location of the skate, like requiring the trailing skate to touch the ice for offside. So, in amateur North American hockey, because the goalie's skates cross the red line, the referee would blow the whistle and penalize the goalie, regardless of where the puck is.
Perfectly deduced. Under USA and Canada rules, a goaltender is not allowed to participate in the play if their skates cross the center red line. It results in a minor penalty. You have successfully integrated the geometric philosophy of the rule books.
That brings us perfectly to our final section. We just talked about the goaltender crossing the center line, which is rare. Goaltenders spend 99% of the game in their own heavily guarded geographic bubble. Let's talk about the most protected player on the ice and the highly specific painted geometry that governs their existence, the goaltender's fortress.
The primary fortress for the goaltender is the goal crease. Visually, this is the area of ice painted light blue, shaped like a semicircle directly in front of the net.
I always pictured the crease as just a flat mat painted on the ice, a safe zone for the goalie to stand on.
That is a common simplification, but legally it is inaccurate. The goal crease is not a two-dimensional mat. It is a three-dimensional volume. It projects vertically upward from the blue paint on the ice. In most rule books, it extends exactly 4 feet high. In some interpretations, it extends all the way up to the horizontal crossbar of the net. The crease is essentially a physical cylinder of protected space.
Now, when I look at the crease, the blue paint is bordered by a 2-inch-thick red semicircle line. Is that red line considered part of the protected crease, or is it neutral territory?
Under the IIHF, USA Hockey, and Hockey Canada, the rule books are explicit. The red line is part of the crease. If a player's skate is touching that red paint, they have legally entered the goaltender's volume. Curiously, if you read the main text of the NHL rulebook, the status of the red line is completely unstated. It is a bizarre omission. But practically speaking, NHL officials treat the red line as the boundary edge of the crease.
So the crease is a three-dimensional cylinder defined by the red line. The most common penalty we see surrounding this area is goaltender interference. I feel like players, and certainly fans, get this wrong constantly. The assumption is that the goalie is untouchable, like a quarterback in a red practice jersey. If you touch them, it's a penalty. Is that true?
It is a massive misconception. A goaltender is highly protected, but they are not entirely immune to physical contact, provided the context is right. The rulebook allows for incidental contact between an attacking player and a goaltender, specifically if both of them are simultaneously making a genuine effort to play a loose rebound.
So if a shot hits the goalie's pads, the puck bounces 3 feet away, and the goalie and the forward both lunge for it and bump into each other.
That is a legal hockey play. You cannot deliberately run the goaltender over and you cannot push them into the net. But incidental bumping during a legitimate battle for a loose puck outside the blue paint is perfectly legal.
What about screening? This is a huge tactical part of the game. A massive forward parks themselves directly in front of the goaltender to block their line of sight while the defenseman shoots from the point. The goalie is trying to peer around them, pushing them in the back. Is that legal?
Screening is a perfectly legal tactical maneuver, provided the attacker respects the three-dimensional volume we just defined. An attacking player has every right to establish position in the goaltender's sight line. The only restriction is that they must do so outside the crease.
And since we established that the red line is part of the crease.
The practical on-ice advice for a forward is simple: get right in the goaltender's eyes. Make their life miserable. Force them to look around your hips. But look down at your skates and ensure your steel blades are strictly off the red line and out of the blue paint. If your skates are in the white ice and you are not physically preventing the goalie from moving within their crease, you are executing a legal screen. If your toe slips onto the red line and contact occurs, you are guilty of interference.
Okay, so that covers the front of the net. Let's look behind the net. In the NHL and international games, there are two red lines starting at the goal line and angling outward toward the end boards, forming a shape behind the net. This is called the trapezoid. Why does this geometric shape exist and what does it restrict?
The trapezoid is a relatively modern invention, introduced by the NHL to curb the influence of highly skilled puck-handling goaltenders like Martin Brodeur. Before the trapezoid, goaltenders could skate into the deep corners of the rink, retrieve dumped pucks, and fire breakout passes up the ice, effectively acting as a third defenseman. It stifled offensive forechecking. So the NHL painted the trapezoid. In the NHL and IIHF, the trapezoid represents the only area behind the goal line where the goaltender is legally allowed to play the puck.
If the opposing team dumps the puck into the corner, outside of those trapezoid lines, and the goalie skates over to play it.
It is an automatic 2-minute minor penalty for delay of game. The goaltender is strictly confined to that specific geometric area if they venture behind the goal line.
Let me present a desperate scenario. My team's defenseman is racing back to retrieve a puck in the deep corner. A massive opposing forward is right behind him, preparing to deliver a crushing body check. The goalie sees this happening. The goalie just wants to step 2 feet outside the trapezoid, quickly tap the puck to safety, and save their teammate from getting obliterated. Can the referee apply common sense and let that slide?
A hard no. The lines are absolute. If the goaltender stick plays the puck outside the trapezoid lines behind the goal line, it is a penalty. However, there is one highly specific geometric exception to this rule. A goaltender is allowed to reach out and play a puck in the corner only if they maintain physical skate contact with the goal crease.
Ah, so if the goalie keeps one toe anchored in the blue paint, they can stretch their stick out as far as they want into the restricted area.
Exactly. But if that anchor skate leaves the crease, they are fully subject to the trapezoid restrictions.
Now, what about the amateur leagues? Because I don't recall seeing trapezoids painted on local community rinks.
You don't, because USA Hockey and Hockey Canada do not utilize the trapezoid rule. In North American amateur hockey, the goaltender is free to roam into the deep corners to play the puck. However, they implement a different restriction to keep the game flowing. An amateur goaltender can go into the corner to pass the puck, but if they go into the corner and intentionally fall on the puck or freeze it against the boards to force a stoppage in play, they will be penalized for delay of game. They are granted the freedom of movement, but they are denied the ability to kill the play outside their crease.
We have covered an immense amount of ground today. We have traced the physical lines of the rink, explored the biomechanics of illegal hits, decoded the confusing web of penalties, and defined the geometry of the goaltender. Our stated goal at the beginning of this deep dive was to build a comprehensive, integrated mental framework of the sports rulebook. Let's pull all these disparate threads together and synthesize exactly what we have learned.
If we synthesize this material into a cohesive model, three foundational principles emerge that govern the reality of ice hockey. First and foremost, geography dictates consequence.
Okay, geography.
The painted lines on the ice, the blue line, the center red line, the crease volume, the trapezoid, they are not mere suggestions or visual aids. They are absolute legal boundaries that trigger immediate physical and strategic realities. A matter of inches at the blue line dictates the mechanics of an offside entry. A face-off dot dictates the terrifying exhaustion of a hybrid icing call. The physical location of a puck versus a skate dictates whether a delay of game penalty is assessed. You must know exactly where you are on the ice at all times.
Second, safety trumps human instinct. We saw this vividly with the head contact rules and the checking from behind penalties, but it was most apparent with the ducking rule.
Yes, exactly.
The rulebook is actively engineered to force safe biomechanics. It prioritizes keeping your cervical spine aligned over your natural human instinct to curl into a defensive ball. The rules dictate that you must keep your head up and absorb contact properly. If you turn your back or if you duck, the rulebook will not protect you. It will actively penalize you for endangering yourself.
And third, jurisdiction is absolute. You can never assume the rules of hockey are universal. The NHL operates as a highly specific, commercially driven, and frankly, more physically lenient professional standard.
The outliers.
Right. If you play in the United Kingdom under the IIHF or in North American amateur leagues under USA Hockey or Hockey Canada, your threshold for being ejected from the game is vastly lower. Your physical mechanics for crossing the blue line shift from hovering in the air to dragging a skate on the ice. Your strategic freedom during an icing call changes completely.
So if a player is listening and lacing up their skates tonight, what are the core practical applications they need to take onto the ice with them?
Take these physical mechanics with you. First, know your specific blue line rule before the puck drops. Ask the referee if you need to drag your trail skate or if you can let it hover. Second, know the icing consequences. Are you allowed to substitute tired players, or are you going to be trapped on the ice? Third, when an offside arm goes up, hit the brakes immediately. Do not chase the puck carrier. Retreat and tag up.
Just back off.
Exactly. Fourth, never tuck your chin or turn your back to avoid a hit along the boards. Take it on the shoulder. And fifth, if you are screening the goalie, look down at your boots. Ensure your steel is entirely in the white ice, physically detached from the red line of the crease.
If you can internalize those mechanics, you are no longer just reacting to the referee's whistle. You are actively utilizing the rulebook as a strategic advantage. You understand the architecture of the game. I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you process all of this. We opened this discussion with a board game analogy. We have spent an hour seeing how the rules shift wildly depending on what logo happens to be printed on the cover of the rulebook.
We really did.
We are talking about rules that alter the physical mechanics of how a skate blade touches the ice, rules that dictate the biomechanical safety of a collision, and rules that trigger the physiological paralysis of an icing substitution ban. If the rules of a game physically dictate the safety, the territorial strategy, and the literal bodily movements of how human beings engage with one another, are the National Hockey League and the International Amateur Leagues even truly playing the same sport?
It is a profound philosophical question. They are undeniably sharing the same icy board, but the legal moves available to the pieces are fundamentally different.
Exactly. Keep that in mind. The next time you sit down to watch a Saturday night NHL game and then flip the channel to watch an international tournament on Sunday, do not just follow the puck. Look closer. Watch how the players physically approach the painted blue line. Watch the aggressive proximity during a delayed offside. Watch how they brace for impacts along the wall. You aren't just watching a hockey game. You're watching two completely distinct legal universes colliding on the ice.